Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Baer. Professor Baer is a neuroscientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and his lab studies the visual system. They study the pathophysiology and methods for correcting amblyopia, which is a prevalent form of visual impairment. They study how the visual system works, and they do a lot of work, both experimental and theoretical, that has to do with synaptic plasticity, how cells and circuits in the brain, primarily in the visual system, respond and change, and how experience drives changes across the development of the brain. They look at ways to treat visual impairments like amblyopia, and we talked about a lot of that work. We talked about some of the basics of the visual system, how the brain actually produces visual images, all the way from the retina through to the visual cortex. We talked about some of the key nodes in the visual system. We talked about synaptic plasticity and different forms of plasticity like long-term depression and potentiation, how connections between neurons get weaker or stronger in response to experience. We talked about some of the treatments that his lab has used to actually treat amblyopia in animals and how close they are to actually doing something like that in human beings. We talked a lot about critical periods of development in the visual system, how certain periods of development are crucial for the proper development of the visual system, how experience within those critical periods is necessary to drive the proper development of the circuitry. We talked about metaplasticity. We talked about whether critical periods can actually be reopened in adulthood and whether metaplasticity can be induced later in life when some of these critical periods have been closed, and whether this might be a way to enable neuroplastic changes that are otherwise not going to happen in adults. We talked about things like ketamine and psychedelics and whether they might be tools for doing this. And we talked about some other methods for doing it as well. So if you're interested in the visual system in the brain, how the visual system actually works, if you're interested in visual impairments like amblyopia and what scientists are working on to actually cure those conditions and how close we are to seeing those in human beings, if you're interested in neuroplasticity and metaplasticity and some of the emerging tools that neuroscientists are using to try and engage those phenomena to actually fix brain circuits that have gone awry, this is a really interesting episode for you, and Mark shared a lot of really cool stuff. As always, don't forget to check out the Mind and Matter podcast at mindandmatter.substack.com. Also, check out the links in the episode description, both to that Substack and to some of my affiliate partners. They are making really cool products that I use, everything from at-home blood testing, so you can get dozens of markers that tell you about your health, to devices that help you track your metabolism and how it's responding to your diet and your lifestyle. And don't forget, the best way to help the podcast grow is to just share your favorite episodes with family and friends. So if you like what I'm doing here, please share that with people that you know. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Mark Baer. Can you start off by just telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what your lab studies?
Well, I'm a neuroscientist. I currently hold the position of Picower Professor of Neuroscience at MIT. And we have been studying how experience modifies the brain for the duration of my career. And a lot of our recent work is really focused on trying to apply some of the knowledge that we've gained to correct mishaps of development that arise either from poor experience or gene mutations.
And so when we think about the visual system, obviously this is a sensory system that our body has. It detects light. We have different sensory systems that detect different aspects of the physical environment. In the retina of the eyeball, how is the nervous system actually detecting those photons? And what are some of the key features that those sensory neurons have that enable them to do that?
That's a deep topic. And I will just tell you right off the bat, Nick, that I take a lot of what goes on in the retina for granted, for better or worse, because most of our studies are focused on the cerebral cortex, which is the first place in the ascending visual pathway where information from the two eyes is combined. So we're very interested in the neural substrate of binocular vision. That's why we see one world with two eyes. And we can also see stereoscopic depth. But to answer your question, there are photopigments in the retina in specialized cells called photoreceptors, and they absorb these photons. And there's a chemical change that ultimately results in a change in the voltage across the membrane of those photoreceptors. And as a result of that membrane voltage change, there is a change in the release of a neurotransmitter, which is glutamate, the common amino acid glutamate. And then the glutamate tickles, the most direct pathway is tickling another cell type in the retina called bipolar cells. And bipolar cells in turn talk to retinal ganglion cells. And the retinal ganglion cells are the first cells in the retina that generate nerve impulses that then sweep up the optic nerves. And so it's the retinal ganglion cell activity that is how we see. That's how the information gets from the eye into the brain.
So you said that the visual cortex, which is going to be a number of synapses away from the retina, that's the first place that information from both eyes gets combined. And as you said, we see one visual scene. I have one image in my mind right now, and yet I've got these two channels of information coming from my left eye and my right eye. Can you give us a basic sense for what is some of the key architecture and circuitry that is enabling that is the reason for why I have one image, even though I've got these two separate channels of visual information?
Sure. Yeah, it's a miracle of development and evolution that these two rather independently developing structures, the two eyes, giving rise to connections that somehow find their way into the brain, and they make a first relay in part of the brain called the thalamus, and then these thalamic and in the thalamus, in most species, the information from the two eyes remains segregated. And then that information goes from thalamus through a projection to the visual cortex, which is you can see it from the surface of the brain where the visual cortex is. And that is the it's neurons in the visual cortex are the first place where you find responses to stimulation of either eye. So they're strictly speaking binocular. Now, just to contemplate for a second how amazing it is that there's a mapping of points of visual space that talk to ganglion cells in either eye. And somehow those ganglion cells, or the output of those ganglion cells, finds its way on a single target in the visual cortex. And the precision of these connections, well, it's essential that these connections be precise to serve binocular vision. And it sort of led Hubel and Wiesel, who were the real pioneers in studying the ascending visual pathway, to ask the question, is there a role for visual experience in the development of these very precise connections? And to test their hypothesis, they did a very simple manipulation of visual experience, and many labs are still doing it today, is temporarily depriving one eye of vision during infancy or early childhood, or in animal models, very early after birth. And then the eye is opened, and they ask, what's the consequence of growing up with an imbalance in the activity from the two eyes? And what we know in virtually every species that uses both eyes, ranging from mouse to man, is that there is a very dramatic change in the anatomy and the physiology of the visual cortex, so that most cortical neurons serve only the eye that was non-deprived, and the deprived eye connections are lost or greatly weakened. So that paradigm, which was introduced in 1963, has been used repeatedly to gain insights into the very basic question of how does experience modify the brain? That's how I got into it. It was a very ba just a basic science question. It's, wow, how does experience modify the brain? Here's a system where the modifications are profound and dramatic and easily studied. And so maybe we can get under the hood and find out what's going on. But I should also mention that this experimental paradigm of depriving one eye of vision occurs in nature rather frequently in humans, where an infant may be born with an uneven refraction in the two eyes so that they can't form a crisp image in both eyes at the same time. So there's an imbalance. Or they may be born with the eyes that drift apart or drift together, a condition called strabismus. Or in the most severe cases, they may be born with a cataract in one eye. So the consequences in a human are just what we would predict from the animal studies, which is that there is a profound loss of visual acuity in one of the eyes. If it was the deprived eye, that input is greatly diminished at the level of the cortex, and there's a profound impairment in vision and stereopsis. So what's cool about this area is that not only do we have some deep basic science questions to address, we also have some pretty clinically relevant questions to address as well. So to answer your question, the rambling answer to a very simple question, which is that how is this convergence normally organized? And there it's interesting that it really depends on the species, or put another way, the evolutionary history of the species. Mm-hmm. So what we learn about monkeys and humans and some carnivores like cats is that the information arrives in the cortex. There's an intermingling of the inputs from the two eyes, but then they segregate out into these structures called ocular dominance columns. So part of the cortex actually still conserves this information from right eye or left eye. And then it's those neurons within the cortex that converge onto other neurons that bring the information together. So in the human weasel showed that one of the consequences of monocular deprivation was a really dramatic, spectacular change in the dimensions of these ocular dominance columns, so that the area of cortex serving the non-deprived eye expanded, and the area of cortex serving the deprived eye contracted. So we can have a beautiful picture of what's going on at the anatomical level. Now, I should say that ocular dominance columns that exist in humans, cats, and monkeys are not universally shared by all species. So I'll give you an extreme counterexample is a tree shrew. And in the same layer where we see ocular dominance columns in old world monkeys, what you see in a tree shrew is, instead of there being columns, they're stripes. So it's the same solution of keeping the information segregated, but same objective, but different solution, sort of 90 degrees off. Similarly, in other species, particularly in rodents, we don't see any ocular dominance columns at all. We see the intermingling of the two eyes really at the first relay in the cortex. So there's many different substrates of this binocular vision. But one thing that is in common in all these species is that early deprivation disrupts these connections.
So the visual system, you know, our eyeballs are the organ that detect the light. We've got special pigment proteins in the retina that have evolved to be able to sense the presence of photons within the visible spectrum. You've got these two channels of information, your left eye, your right eye. Those channels are separate, and they first converge in the visual cortex, the primary visual cortex, which would be all the way on the backside of the brain. And the fact that we have one visual scene means that somehow we're combining these two separate streams of information in a way that gives us that one unified scene, and we're not seeing double vision all the time. And that's first happening in the cerebral cortex, and that amounts to cells in the cortex that sense information from one eye and cells that sense information from the other eye, then converging and projecting and sending information to cells that are hooked up to both.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And so there's this experience dependence that we're going to talk about, meaning, you know, you talked about how if you just shut off vision for a while in early development by preventing light from getting into one eye, this changes. The the structure of the visual system. And so it sounds like if you stick an electrode into the primary visual cortex, as many people have done over the years, you've got patches of tissue where neurons are primarily responding to one eye, and patches of tissue where they primarily respond to inputs from the other eye. But if you deprive one of those eyes in early development, more of that real estate of the cortex is going to be occupied by cells responding to the non-deprived eye.
That is well said.
And so one question I have before we kind of get into some of the stuff that you work on and neuroplasticity and lots of other things is why, what is this architecture and some of the things we're going to talk about, what does it say about the why don't we have this architecture hard-coded in the genome?
Well, the genome never ceases to amaze me. Early development of precise connections in the brain can really be guided very much by instructions that reside in the genome. So I think maybe our first assumption is that the genetic instructions alone couldn't possibly accomplish this was probably a false assumption. And in fact, there was a considerable debate several decades ago now about whether these regions of cortex where the inputs from the two eyes are segregated, whether that segregation process requires visual experience or not. So the earliest data suggested that, just to recap, very early in development, the inputs are intermingled, and then they segregate out to form these ocular dominance domains. And originally, it was thought that that segregation process really depended on a comparison of activity in the left and right eyes. But later work suggests, at least in some species, that that striping pattern can occur purely by genetic instructions. So it's sort of, you can sort of get there's not going to be a hard and fast answer that's going to apply to every species. I mean, a really great example, honestly, is a crazy experiment. Well, crazy, an exotic experiment done by someone named Martha Constantine Patton, who was then at Princeton and was more recently at MIT. And she did an interesting experiment in frogs. So frogs have an almost entirely crossed visual pathway, because the frog eyes are laterally placed on the head. So if you take species, especially, reptiles and amphibia and birds, most birds other than owls, but let's stick to reptiles and amphibia. They have laterally placed eyes. They don't have much of a substrate for binocular vision. So points in space are either seen by the eye on the same side or the eye on the other side. But what Martha did was that she transplanted a embryonic eye bud into tadpoles. And, the amazing thing about frogs is that that eye bud could take and form an eye, and the connections would go into the brain. And what she discovered was that they segregated out into these ocular dominant stripes when they went in. So it was sort of like, no genetic instructions there. It was purely driven by comparison of activity between the supernumerary eye and the animal's normal eye. So, long-winded way of saying that we can solve a lot of these problems with the genetic solution. But in the end, there's no denying the effect of manipulating visual experience in all of these species. In all of these species, a manipulation of visual experience disrupts these connections.
When you deprive one eye of the ability to sense light and you see these changes throughout the visual system, these experience-dependent changes, how important is the specific developmental window in which the deprivation happens?
I'm glad you asked that question. So the short answer is that the vulnerability to monocular deprivation is very age dependent. And so this is fairly easily mapped out in animal species where you can look at the consequences of early monocular deprivation that is initiated at different ages. And it's been known for a long time, again, originating with Huon Weasel, that at a certain age, the cortex is resistant to the effects of manipulating experience. And, so this gave rise to this idea of a critical period. There's a period of postnatal development where the fine-tuning of these connections requires interaction with experience. And you can ask yourself, why has nature come up with this? Why would it be advantageous for the cortex to be vulnerable to deprivation as you develop? And I think that the deprivation experiments are actually revealing that the brain is trying to make maximal use of the effective inputs that it has at any given time. So what it's doing is reallocating neural tissue to a seeing eye or an eye that's forming crisp images. And it's disadvantaging the other eye because it's not helpful. It's not useful. So it's a matter really of making the most of what you've got, and it's interacting with experience to do that. There is a sort of a flip side to this whole thing, which is that, as I mentioned, in human infants, let's just take the most severe example of a cat being born with a cataract in one eye, which is rare, but not, ultra rare.
And can you just remind everyone what exactly is a cataract?
Oh, sure. Yes. It's a clouding of it's a clouding of the lens in the eye. And so it's impossible to form a crisp image on the back of the eye. And cataracts are very common in adults, of course, especially as we get older. And they're quite easily treated. Their lens is removed and it's replaced. And happily, you can develop cataracts in adulthood and it can go untreated for a good long time. And there's no lasting deleterious consequence. Once the cataract is treated, vision is restored. And that's because you're beyond your critical period. You're no longer vulnerable to this imbalance in visual input. So
Brain,
that's
the
a good
brain
thing.
retains the structure's already there. It already knows how to deal with information from both eyes. So you just wipe the lens off or replace the lens, and
That's right.
it goes right
But
back. It things work as they should.
things get interesting. So on the therapeutic side of this, as I mentioned, so we have unilateral cataract, you're born with unilateral cataract. And the question is, how are we gonna save the visual system? And so of course, the answer is that, well, first thing you have to do is remove the cataract. So if you are in a medically well-served community, you have excellent health care, it's noticed early in life, and you can't delay. You have to go in and correct that cataract. And typically, that alone is, well, it's necessary, but not sufficient to see a recovery. What is additionally done is that the strong eye or the good eye, the intact eye, or we call it the fellow eye, is often patched for periods of time. And the reason is that it sort of forces the other eye to be used by the baby. And so that other eye sometimes is called the lazy eye. So it's forcing the lazy eye to work. And if you initiate treatment early enough, you can get a pretty nice recovery. Not necessarily a full recovery of binocular vision, but you can get acuity back to that eye that had been deprived by the cataract. But here's the rub. The rub is that that treatment effect is restricted to a critical period. So if you don't do this manipulation early enough, you won't see a recovery. And the duration of the critical period sort of depends on the critical period for treatment. depends on the cause of the underlying visual condition. By the way, I don't think I've defined it, the visual condition. It's called amblyopia, which is, you can practice saying that, but amblyopia. And that is simply, amblyopia is a visual impairment, typically restricted to one eye, for which there is no observable cause in the retina or eye. So it's a visual impairment that is occurring elsewhere in the brain, typically in the visual cortex. And it's not uncommon. So it affects about 4 or 5% of the population.
How does that typically manifest in terms of their visual experience if it's untreated?
If it's untreated, the amblyopic eye is not useful. It's not useful.
So
They've
it's like
lost.
monocular deprivation.
It is, yes, exactly. I mean, monocular deprivation is a perfect model of what's called deprivation amblyopia, which is that which would be caused by a cataract. And I will say that if amblyopia is caused by deprivation, the critical period in humans ends very young, before 1 year of age. So you don't have a lot of time to hop on this and try to set things right before these connections are formed and then frozen in place, basically.
I'd imagine, a 6-month-old baby has no good way of telling us that their vision is impaired, so this is probably often missed.
That's true. You know, that is totally a very good point. And now there are other more sort of less severe causes of amblyopia, but also insidious. So one is called anisotrometropia. I can't even say it. But anyway, it's the uneven refraction in the two eyes. Now, you know, I'm wearing glasses. I need an optical correction so I can form a crisp image on my eyes. And as you know, if you wear glasses, that often your prescription can differ in the two eyes. You know, one eye might be weaker than the other eye, having to do with differences in the shape of the eyeball or the curvature of the surface of the eye. Not uncommon, right? Refractive errors. But if you have a refractive errors that differ in the two eyes early in development, you set up a situation where you can only really form a crisp image on one retina or the other, but never at the same time. And that is another condition that causes amblyopia. And that's a condition that can go untreated if you don't have timely eye exams. So that's why this early neonatal medical care is so important. And it's so easily missed if you don't have that. Cataracts, of course, are obvious. It's a clouding of the eye. Strabismus is obvious because the eyes aren't lined up properly. But you're definitely, regardless of the cause, you're working against the clock. And I think one of the lasting legacies of Hubel and Wiesel's work was the recognition that you got to start early. You can't, wait indefinitely for the skull to get hard and the subject to be able to tolerate surgery better. But you got to get right onto it.
What are so in these critical periods of the visual system, what's going on in terms of neuroplasticity? What kinds of plasticity are only allowed during that period, or how are the cells behaving differently? What's actually shutting off when we start to look under the hood?
Yeah, it's really an interesting question. It's one that's really preoccupied one or two generations of neuroscientists. The idea is to understand why this plasticity, we call it, diminishes with age. And is there something we can do to boost it in the adult? So, of course, it's a multifaceted problem, and sort of the approach that we have taken is trying first and foremost to understand, just to give you an example, what's the mechanism by which connections that are wired to an eye deprived of vision lose strength in the cortex? What's the mechanism of that? And I might belief is that if when we understand that mechanism, we have a shot at understanding how to reverse it. So that's the approach that we've taken. I mean, everybody's got a different, point of view on this, but that's what we've taken. And I will say that we know a great deal about the mechanisms that cause the loss of synaptic strength. So I can tell you a little bit about that if you'd like.
Yeah, let's give people a basic sense for some of the things, at least, that can happen here when these experience dependent changes actually happen.
Sure. So the inputs to the cortex that we're talking about, they use glutamate as a neurotransmitter. So just to review, glutamate is the neurotransmitter at about 80% of the synapses in the brain. And it is, in almost all cases, excitatory, meaning that it causes the neurons that it's communicating with to become active. And so this information that's coming into the cortex from the two eyes is using glutamate as a neurotransmitter. And what happens during deprivation is that temporally structured activity in the retinas is disrupted. So what do I mean by that? As we look at images, you can imagine shadows crossing the retinas, edges, bars, colors. And there's a spatiotemporal correlation in the activity, so that neighboring cells are active at the same time when you're being activated by a stimulus that, for example, includes much of the visual field. And it's sort of that correlated activity that leads to the fine-tuning of connections in the brain. In the case of deprivation, what happens is that spatiotemporal correlation of activity breaks down. So when we talk about patching an eye, it is not the same, and importantly, it's not the same as shutting the eye off. So it's not the absence of activity that's the problem. It's the presence of activity that no longer is well correlated that is the problem. So in the case of macular deprivation, you just imagine that you have one eye that's giving rise to this beautifully correlated activity as visual stimuli are sweeping across the retina, and the other eye is just static. It's just stuck between radio stations, right? It's just noise. And it is that noise that drives the connections in the brain down. So that loss of synaptic strength is referred to as long-term depression, or shorthand for as LTD.
I see. So long-term depression, the strength, the connection between neurons is decreasing. It's getting weaker. It's not referring to depression in
Yeah,
the,
exactly.
yeah.
Yeah, not to be confused with the major depressive disorder, but this is a synaptic effect. It's widespread in the brain, especially during development,
I
and it
see.
serves a useful purpose to winnow out synapses that aren't conveying useful information.
I see. So the pattern of activity, the temporal structure, how activity between and across neurons is correlated, that can drive neuroplastic changes such as a weakening of connections, which is what we're talking about here.
That's part, yeah, correct. Correct. So, with this sort of insight that it's not the absence of activity, but the presence of activity that doesn't correlate with the activation of the target neurons in the visual cortex, that we could go in and do experiments and ask, can we recreate that phenomenon in the laboratory? Once we have a preparation where we can study it, we can start to dissect the mechanisms. And we have, and we know a great deal about the early molecular events that occur when you've replaced pattern activity with noise. So we have a decent understanding of what's the pathophysiology that triggers this loss of visual responsiveness. And I think, and the as I said, the phenomenon that we can study is called long-term depression or LTD.
So, the system that you study, you've got a a good anatomical map of all the connections. You guys have gotten into some of the electrophysiological mechanisms. You understand things like long-term depression and how that relates to the visual experience and the deprivation. When it comes to something like amblyopia, how in experimental animal models, how have you guys treated this and what does that involve in terms of changing neural activity?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. So, you know, we deprive an eye of vision, we induce LDD, those synapses get weaker. We have an extremely exquisite understanding of the mechanisms that are involved in that. And the question is, can we bring those synapses back to life? And we can start with, we may be able to start with what happens clinically. So clinically, I mentioned that the strategy is to patch the good eye, to force vision through the weak eye. And so you have to restore vision through the eye that had been affected. In other words, remove the cataract or realign the eyes or correct the refractive error. Okay, that's obligatory. And then what you want to do is try to promote the recovery of synaptic strength in the cortex through that eye. And the way it's done clinically is to patch the good eye. And indeed, we can do this in the animal models of amblyopia, and it works. You patch the fellow eye, and then you can see the responses come back to the deprived eye. Again, restricted to a critical period, but nevertheless, it gives you some hopeful news, which is that the deprivation effect is not permanent. It can be reversed with timely treatment. And then we have the opportunity to understand, okay, what's the mechanism by which the recovery occurs? And I'd say we probably know less than we think we know, but this is what we think we know, is that connections get stronger. So I said connections get weaker when the input activity is poorly correlated with the activity of the postsynaptic target cell. On the other hand, we know that synapses get stronger when input activity consistently does correlate with evoked activity in the target cell. So in other words, when the presynaptic input is active at the same time or just shortly before the postsynaptic neuron is active, then we know that that's a favorable condition to make synapses stronger. And that's another phenomenon that's been studied for a number of decades now. And it's called long-term potentiation, LTP. So it's the flip side of LTD is LTP. So what we think is happening is that LTP is occurring at these weakened synapses and causing them to gain strength. But there's a conundrum here, which is we know that LTP typically requires very strong, robust correlations between the presynaptic input and the postsynaptic cell. But in the case of, I love this example in the case of patching, because when we patch, we have the seeing eye is no longer providing input. That is to say, the strong eye is no longer providing input, and the seeing eye is too weak to elicit a response. That's the deprived eye. So how is it ever possible to satisfy the conditions required for long-term potentiation? Hmm. Right? It seems unlikely that it could work, and yet it does. So the question is, what is it about patching the fellow eye that enables this long-term potentiation to occur? And if we understood that, we might be able to come up with some clever ways to exploit that even after the critical period. So my work is strongly influenced by a theory of synaptic modification, a mathematical theory of synaptic modification that was developed by a colleague and friend at Brown University when I was on the faculty there many years ago. And his name is Leon Cooper. And Leon is well known. because he won the Nobel Prize in physics for a theory of superconductivity. It was called the BCS theory. And he won the Nobel Prize, I think it was in 1972. And as many Nobel laureates do, their minds start to wander, and he became interested in another insoluble problem, such as learning and memory in the brain. And he was interested to know if he could develop a learning rule, a sort of a set of rules that govern the modification of synapses based on experience. And Leon had the extremely good taste to not do this in sort of a vacuum, but to try to do it in a context that where his assumptions could be experimentally validated. So it's one thing to say just dream up solutions and run computer simulations, but it's really quite another to say, okay, I'm going to try to apply this theory to observations, that can experimental observations. And at that time, the preeminent model to look at experience-dependent plasticity in the brain was the visual cortex. So he made his theory. He constructed this theory very with the express purpose of having it tested experimentally in the visual cortex. So for me, this was like, I mean, I'm much his junior, but he was very kind to teach me about his theory, and I was tried to reciprocate by teaching him a little bit about the biology of synaptic transmission. And we came up with some ideas for what the synaptic mechanisms might be. In fact, I will just say that Leon's theory, which is called the BCM theory, was really the inspiration for the discovery of long-term depression. That discovery was made in 1992, and it was really motivated by Leon's theory. But so returning to why patching works, so that's a great question, and I was puzzling over it myself. And I said, "How do you guys solve this problem?" And what he proposed in his theory was that the threshold level of correlation between pre and postsynaptic activity that is required for long-term potentiation is not a fixed value, but rather it can adjust depending on the average activity of the postsynaptic cells. So intuitively, this makes beautiful sense. So just to recap a little bit, so imagine that there's a degree of correlation of pre and postsynaptic activity that elicits LTP. And if you're less than that threshold, you get LTD instead at active synapses. So there's a crossover point, and he called that point the modification threshold. Now, you can imagine in a neural network where all the synaptic weights were set a little bit too high so that always the synapses were exceeding the modification threshold, then all the synapses would strengthen and the whole system would sort of blow up, or it would saturate all the synaptic weights.
Yeah, there's no real refinement. There's no specificity. Everything is just,
Yeah,
yeah.
the no constraints on it. It just goes to one. Conversely, if you set all your synaptic weights a little bit too low, it would all go to zero,
Yep.
right? Everybody would undergo LTD. So we said, well, obviously, this is not a robust solution, right? So the idea they came up with was to let this threshold level slide back and forth as a function of the average activity of the cell. So now think about this. Let's think about it in the context of patching. So we set up a situation where the seeing eye isn't strong enough to elicit a response in the cortex, and the strong eye isn't seeing. So what's going to happen in the cortex? The assumption is, it's a reasonable assumption, is that the activity in the cortex is going to fall, and as a consequence of that, there's going to be an adjustment in the value of this threshold. So it's just going to make it easier to get LTP. It's going to make it less stringent, the conditions to get LTP. And so he calls this the sliding modification threshold. And it's really a mechanism to maintain homeostasis of synapses in a network of neurons. And so they've done a lot of simulations and so on to show that it's a very robust way of storing information and so on. And it's actually been, created in silico as well. There are chips that have BCM modifications on them. But in the context of treating of this patch therapy, that's the way we imagine that it works, which is that you've changed the conditions required to get LTP so that the weak input, although it's weak, it's now correlated because you've restored visual clarity in the eye. And that these weak correlations are now adequate or sufficient to drive those synapses up. And
So
so that's the.
by patching the good eye, there's less overall information going to the cortex. The threshold the brain is then setting for what it needs to see in order to strengthen a synapse goes down. So now it's easier, and that's what's enabling LTP to come from the amblyopic eye.
Perfect. Yep, exactly. Exactly.
One,
And that,
oh, go ahead.
I was just going to introduce a term because, so this is Leon's theory, and that's the sliding threshold, but there are other examples where the prior history of activity can affect the rules of synaptic plasticity. And I was really fortunate to do my sabbatical in New Zealand with a colleague named Cliff Abraham. And we were trying to think of a term that could capture the general concept that plasticity rules at any given moment depend on what happened before, basically. And we came up with the term metaplasticity. And metaplasticity is now a widely used expression. And basically, in most cases, it's capturing the essence of the sliding threshold of the BCM theory.
Yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense. I didn't know about this theory, by the way. So this is interesting. So, metaplasticity, it's easy to think about that in terms of something like the critical period, right? There's this critical period, which is the brain has a heightened capacity to engage in things like long-term depression or potentiation. And when that window closes, that corresponds to a lessened ability for those specific types of neuroplasticity to actually be triggered.
The statements you've made are correct, except that the metaplasticity piece of it need not be what's controlling the critical period. So the vulnerability to deprivation diminishes with age, and that's, I'm sure, a good thing. And that really doesn't have much to do with metaplasticity, we don't think. We think that there are very likely another set of mechanisms that open and close this window of plasticity in the brain. And I think a very simple way of thinking about this is that everything we're talking about depends on the input activity and the levels of correlation. And the input activity is under the control of inhibitory mechanisms in the brain. Now, I get a lot of mileage out of just thinking about excitatory synapses, and I am usually reminded that there's more to the brain than excitation. And in fact, I would say the prevailing theory right now for what brings the critical period to a close is the maturation of inhibitory mechanisms in the cortex. I think there's almost a consensus on that point. I think what's less clear at this stage is what is it about maturing inhibition that curtails the plasticity of excitatory synapses. And sort of an easy explanation, which I'm sure is at least partially true, is that the inhibition filters out the patterns of activity. Since all this plasticity is driven by patterns of activity, if you turn down the volume on those things, you'll have less plasticity. So I think that that's considered the most likely explanation for what's ending the critical period.
And when we talk about treating something like amblyopia, or just reversing some impairment of the visual system, you've told us about this critical period, this window in which you have the opportunity to make those changes. And if you get past that window, if it closes, then it's much harder to correct the problem. So you have to come up with solutions and apply them during this window. But another strategy that you can imagine in principle is you could somehow induce the brain to become more sensitive and more plastic again. Is that feasible? Is that something people think about?
Yeah, it's great. It is. And so, you know, I just put the kibosh on metaplasticity as the basis for the ending of the critical period. But I will say that we could, perhaps one might exploit metaplasticity to enable recovery of vision in the context of amblyopia or any other disorder of brain wiring. And it was with that motivation that a former student of mine, Betsy Quinlan, who's now at University of Wisconsin, did an experiment that I wish I had done, but she did it, and it was a beautiful experiment. And she took animals that were rendered amblyopic, so they have long-term monocular deprivation. They reopened the eye, but there was a permanent visual disability through one eye. So modeling untreated amblyopia in a human. And then what she did was she put the animals in complete darkness. So a completely dark room, meaning zero photons, no light at all. And she left the animals in there for about 2 weeks or so. And she asked, so you can see the logic here, I suppose, which is to say, okay, the average activity is definitely different if the animals are in the complete darkness. When the animals are returned to light, are we able to sort of now see a recovery of vision? And that's exactly what she saw. So that when the animals were brought out of the dark into the light with both eyes seeing, she got a very nice recovery of vision, so which otherwise would not have been possible. Now, I'll say that her experiments were done in rats. They're not the, you know, gold standard species, at least for relevance to human vision, but the experiments were replicated and by others, particularly Don Mitchell and Kevin Duffy at Dalhousie University, using more traditional species with excellent visual system, and they got exactly the same result. So this was really thrilling that, oh my goodness, maybe we can take advantage of metaplasticity to promote recovery. So there was there are a few details that are important. One is that it did require a long duration of dark exposure. So minimum 10 days in the animal models.
When was this happening in development? Remind us.
Oh, these are in adults.
Okay. In adults. Okay. So the idea is you have a strong deprivation in adulthood after critical periods have already closed. And now.
Let me clarify. So the animals were monocular deprived during the critical period.
Okay. Okay.
Induce amblyopia that would not spontaneously recover. So it's just like a child that grows up with a unilateral cataract, and then the cataract is removed as a young adult, but there's no recovery. So that's kind of the analogy.
Got it. So something goes wrong early in development, and vision is impaired in adulthood.
Right. And so what Betsy showed originally was that you put the animals in the dark for, you know, extended period of time, and when they come back out, now conditions have changed so the visual experience through the amblyopic eye is sufficient to start to drive an increase in responsiveness to that eye. And so this is a very exciting development. Now, I was going to say the caveats here are that the exposure to darkness had to be prolonged. So, as I said, at least 10 days of dark exposure. And it couldn't be interrupted even temporarily by light. It had to literally be a photon-free environment. You couldn't get the same effect by just, for example, putting patches over the eyes, which leave the retinas still quite active and able to respond to luminance changes in the environment. So we were intrigued by this result. And in the meantime, we were doing some experiments using a compound, a drug called tetrodotoxin, or TTX for short. And TTX is isolated from the ovaries of pufferfish, and it's one of the most toxic substances on Earth because it binds tightly to the ion channels that are responsible for nerve impulses. So, you know, there are sushi chefs that train for years to serve pufferfish sushi, which give, when it's perfect, it gives just a slight numbness to the lips and the tongue, but every so often they don't get it right and they'll lose somebody because of a TTX toxicity. So, but it's been an extremely useful tool. And I will say that it is not unreasonable to expect its use therapeutically when you consider botulinum toxin is used therapeutically now as well. So you just have to be careful and use the right dose. And
are you referring to Botox there?
Yeah, I'm referring to Botox. So in any case, we were doing experiments with TTX anyway, and we saw Betsy's results, and we decided we would try to reproduce what she had seen with an injection of TTX into both eyes. So the difference between TTX and darkness is that TTX literally abolishes all the nerve impulse activity in the ganglion cells, whereas exposure to darkness leaves many of those cells active. So many cells are active in the dark. So it is qualitatively different, certainly a more extreme manipulation. But what we discovered was that in bilateral injections of TTX into the eyes, both sides, single injection, would inactivate the retinas for about 24 to 36 hours, and then they would come back. But when they came back, we saw a really dramatic recovery of vision in the amblyopic eye. And what was nice about this study was that we also saw it behaviorally as well. So we had animals that were showing the behaviorally the visual impairment through the amblyopic eye, and the visually guided behavior came back extremely quickly after this treatment.
And is the injection happening during that critical period?
No, this is adults. These are animals that have been, again, rendered amblyopic. They're adults. There's no treatment. There's no hope. They'll forever be blind in one eye.
And then you inject TTX, completely shut off activity in the eyes. And when the drug washes away, when it wears off, you actually can cure the amblyopia?
Yeah. And so the way, the sort of metaphor that I think works is to imagine rebooting your phone. You know, when things start to act wonky, we all know what to do. We shut our phones off and we reboot them, or the computer, same thing. And essentially what we're doing with this bilateral TTX treatment is we're rebooting the visual system. We're saying, okay, you've got yourself in a bad space. You know, you're in a bad place. We're going to reboot and we're going to shut everything off, you know, for a day. And then we're going to restore activity and hopefully now it'll come back. And it does.
And this effect, is this only been done in rodents? Has it been done in primates?
It's been done in cats and mice. Cats and mice.
Is anyone going to attempt a clinical trial on humans?
Yeah, let me take it one step farther. So just let's set that aside for a second. I'm going to take you on a bit of a circuitous journey now, but I'm going to get back to this. So here's the journey. So I've told you that people, there are many millions of people in the world that are adults with amblyopia. They live with it. It does limit things that they can do, and it has societal costs, but they're amblyopic. They see with one good eye. However, occasionally, there is, through a disease or an injury, there is the loss of the good eye, of the fellow eye. So now they're stuck, they're in a terrible situation where the eye that they've been using is no longer functioning. So we would expect from first principles that that's it. You're going to be blind. But what is observed more commonly than not in every case, but more commonly than not, is, and this surprised clinicians, is a gradual recovery of vision through the amblyopic eye, sometimes a full recovery. Okay. So just to recap, so we have an adult amblyope. No treatment would work, no traditional treatment would work. But if the fellow eye is removed, destroyed through disease or injury, then over time there's a recovery of vision through the other eye.
So the bad eye gets better by itself and the good eye goes missing.
Exactly. And so that's kind of a head scratcher. Now, the way people would think about this was they'd say, oh, wow, okay, so the good eye is, sort of exerting a constant suppressive effect on the responses to the other eye. That's called interocular suppression. And that only when you remove that interocular suppression do you see anything coming back in the other eye. And if that were the end of the story, then you would say, well, okay, but nobody's going to lose their good eye to relieve interocular suppression to help recover the amblyopic eye. But the alternate hypothesis is that it's not the perpetual loss of interocular suppression, but rather it's the temporary loss of interocular suppression or metaplasticity that is creating conditions that allow vision through the amblyopic eye to drive a recovery. And so we can test that hypothesis in animals, and we have. And so I told you about bilateral TTX, but the more recent experiments that we've done, and I really should acknowledge Ming-Fei Fong, who is a postdoc in my lab, who is driving a lot of this research, and Kevin Duffy, who's at Dalhousie. The experiment was we rendered animals amblyopic adults. They could only see through one eye, see well through one eye. And then to test our hypothesis, we put TTX into the fellow eye, but only briefly. So we inactivated the fellow eye, but only briefly.
So temporarily inactivate the good eye, and now the bad eye is the only one you can get visual information through. So it's an analogous situation to what you saw in humans, where they lose the good eye and they're left only with the
Exactly,
amblyopic eye.
exactly. Except that the only difference being that we're going to let the good eye come back.
Yeah. So you're
Maybe
losing
like
vision through
removing
that
the good
eye
eye and putting it back in.
so you lose vision through that eye because of TTX, and that's 24 to 36 hours of deprivation.
Yeah, depends on how many injections we do, but minimal 24 hours. Sometimes we do it multiple injections. But what we've seen is that the responses come barreling back through the amblyopic eye. And we've seen this effect in mice and cats and monkeys. So now we're getting really excited about this because we think that there is a translational potential to this approach.
So, the implication here is that if you injected a human being with amblyopia, you put TTX into their good eye, that this could cure them.
Yes, that's the hope. That
And
would be the hope.
is anyone going to literally try doing that in a clinical trial?
I think that it's Safety comes first in all these things, and that we've done a lot of experiments that we are able to do to ensure that there's no lasting toxicity of this treatment, that retinas that are treated are pristine, the visual responses through an activated eye come back fully. So we've done a lot of what we can do. But I think that, we're sort of on a go slow program. We really want to understand the efficacy of the treatment and try to learn as much as we can from animal experiments. But at some point, there'll be a strong case to be made for trying it in humans. And injecting an eye with anything comes with certain risks, but it's also a fairly routine procedure these days. So I think the community of neuro-ophthalmologists are probably divided on whether the benefit would outweigh the risk. But most clinicians that treat people with especially deprivation amblyope are very enthusiastic about this.
So the idea here is that by injecting TTX, a very powerful toxin that shuts off all neural activity, by injecting that into the good eye, you're inducing metaplasticity, and that is enabling the bad eye to become good again in quite a short amount of time. So are there any other strategies that might work in a similar fashion? What I have in mind here is, I talked to Gould Dolan on the podcast, and according to results from her lab, they can actually use drugs like psychedelics to, according to them, reopen critical periods of plasticity. And could something like that be another potential avenue that could be used to do this type of thing?
Yes. It is possible, at least in principle, right? I mean, every approach you take is going to come with, upsides and downsides. And I'm a big fan of Gould's work. I can say that we also have done some experiments ourselves where we use the drug ketamine and found that dosing animals with ketamine could restore juvenile-like plasticity in the adult visual cortex. So this is conceptually similar to what Gould is doing. The TTX treatment, the upside is it's very local to the visual system. It's a circumscribed treatment. There are no systemic effects. Whereas psychedelics or other treatment are systemic. And so you just have to... I guess the big thing is that we're sort of plowing fertile ground now. So we think we have learned that using the knowledge of synaptic plasticity can suggest ways to promote adaptive plasticity in the adult brain. And I think there are going to be a lot of different angles of attack on this, but I'm very excited about that we're going to have a breakthrough sometime in the not too distant future on doing this. And I would also say that the metaplasticity concept is a very useful way to think about any type of neurotherapeutic approach to, loss of function diseases, whether it's be recovery from a stroke, for example, or other neurodegenerative diseases, is like, can we boost synaptic plasticity in a way to recover function? And so I think it's a very useful concept, a way of thinking about it, framework to think about neurotherapeutics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose, to the extent that reopening critical periods, inducing metaplasticity works, in principle, it has... I think kind of what you were getting at there is it has this potential to be an across the board solution to lots of different types of problems in the brain.
Yeah. I think if yes, bottom line, yes. Once people, it could be tinnitus, for example. Tinnitus is probably a disorder of synaptic transmission, neuronal excitability. Can we use our increasingly sophisticated understanding of synapses to come up with a way to quench tinnitus? But that's just one example of many that I think, you know, that it's a way of attacking. It's maybe a fresh perspective on tackling problems.
Mm-hmm. Have there been, I guess, well, let me just ask you this. So two-part question here. One, can you give us some sense of time for how long before people living with amblyopia might, there might be actual clinical work that's done that they can take advantage of? And two, you know, in the meantime, you know, since there's quite a number of people out there, you mentioned this is pretty common with amblyopia, they are impaired by it. They're probably very motivated to fix it. Is there anything they can do that might, you know, give them some amount of recovery by, you know, playing around with their own visual system and, you know, forcing the bad eye to work harder or something like that?
You know, I'm not an authority on this, so I hesitate a little bit, but we do know that there are effective alternate approaches to patching and that work in children that have to do with what's called a dichoptic display. So in other words, instead of eliminating vision in the good eye and forcing vision through the other eye, sort of you try to take advantage of the good eye to help bootstrap the other eye. So they're called dichoptic therapies. And there's a variety of different approaches. And what's really encouraging is that they can yield outcomes in kids that rival the effective patching, even though patching would be considered the sort of medical standard of care right now. These dichoptics procedures are coming online and they have a lot of advantages. One of which is that kids don't mind playing a video game or watching a movie through a dichoptic display, whereas they do not like to have an eye patched, nor do the parents. So that's children. I think it's still rather unexplored territory to know how well these things would work in adults. We also know that there are, we talk about plasticity in the brain being gated by inhibition, for example. And there have been studies done where they've tried manipulations of modulatory neurotransmitters that are familiar that normally regulate levels of inhibition in the cortex. For example, acetylcholine is an example. It's a neurotransmitter that is released during wakefulness in the cortex and less so during sleep. And it's been shown to promote synaptic plasticity. And so there are certain studies that have been done to try to boost the levels of acetylcholine in the brain. And you can imagine clever ways of, okay, combining that plus some smart visual training exercises. You know, the plasticity is in there. We use it. You know, it's how we learn and remember. And it's a question of finding a way to tap into it. So all hope is not lost, I would simply put it that way. And that's one thing we've really shown in the animal studies, is that we can do it. Reducing it to practice is challenging, but we can do it.
Interesting. Is there anything that you want to reiterate for people, or any final thoughts you want to leave them with regarding any of the stuff that we went over today?
I guess I would only say my evangelical comment is think about metaplasticity in a therapeutic context. You know, I'm an expert on visual system plasticity, but there are many other disorders that I think an appreciation for metaplasticity could suggest new strategies for treatment.
Are you guys in your lab doing any work with things, you know, you mentioned you've done some work with ketamine. Are you doing work with any of the drugs that are supposedly reopening or stimulating metaplasticity in the context of what you study in the visual system?
No, we are not. But that's not to say we won't. We are not now. We're very excited about the experiments that we feel would need to be done are to now understand why this fellow eye TTX treatment works. And so we have some very low level but very important questions of how does it work? What's is it a lot? Is it the temporary loss of intraocular suppression, for example? And we need to know the answer to that. And I think as we the one thing that basic science teaches is that once you understand the mechanisms, it may open up entirely new avenues, approaches that could be used therapeutically. So that's what we're really focused on right now.
All right. Well, Dr. Mark Baer, thank you for your time. This was fascinating. And it's just like a wonderful example of connecting the dots all the way from basic science questions all the way to very tangible solutions to clinical problems that are not years and years away, but might be pretty close to coming to fruition.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.